I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The Republican Party ended its convention last night at the White House with Donald Trump accepting his party's nomination for president before a crowd of some 1,500 guests sitting shoulder to shoulder, most of them without masks, cheering on their candidate. Introduced by his daughter Ivanka, Trump claimed a Joe Biden presidency would lead to violence, lawlessness, and chaos, calling him a Trojan horse for socialism. He claimed the country was winning the battle against COVID-19, misrepresenting his administration's missteps containing the virus. He said the U.S. has the lowest coronavirus fatality rate in the world, which is false. He boasted that he's done more for African Americans than any president since Abraham Lincoln, omitting President Johnson signing the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts. He falsely claimed that Biden supports cutting police funding. He does not. He said Biden would abolish the production of domestic fossil fuels. Again, this is false. President Trump said Americans are being given a choice this year.
This is the most important election in the history of our country. At no time before have voters faced a clearer choice between two parties, two visions, two philosophies, or two agendas. This election will decide whether we save the American dream or whether we allow a socialist agenda to demolish our cherished destiny. Your vote will decide whether we protect law-abiding Americans or whether we give free rein to violent anarchists and agitators and criminals who threaten our citizens. And this election will decide whether we will defend the American way of life or whether we will allow a radical movement to completely dismantle and destroy it. That won't happen.
With us now is John Gagne. He's national political correspondent for NPR. And Don Gagne, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Nice to have you with us. I mean, all elections are important. Is the president correct when he says this is the most important in American history?
Well, I guess every voter makes that determination, right? But it clearly is a stark choice. And I will tell you, it's one of those things, one of those rare things where we do have some agreement between the two parties and the two nominees. Whether or not it's the most important in American history or in modern American history or whatever qualifier you want to put on it, both are talking about how it is an election that will have dramatic, dramatic consequences for the country going forward. And,
We'll see what happens. You know, I have to say, I was watching last night when the president was speaking and some of the other speakers as well, and I was worried looking at those 1,500 people, as I mentioned in my introduction, sitting right next to each other, many of them not wearing masks. My understanding is only the front row was tested. I'm just worried that what we were watching was some kind of a super spreader event.
Well, we went through this with Tulsa, right? With that rally, notable because Tulsa became a hot spot afterward. Also notable because former presidential candidate Herman Cain was in that crowd. We can't say for sure that that is where he picked up COVID, but he was there, and now he is deceased. So the question is, what do we see from the people who were in this crowd in 2 weeks? And they were seated side by side, you know, well over 1,000 of them arrayed out in chairs on the South Lawn. And it wasn't like people like picked up their chair and moved it over 6 feet to get a little more distance. Everybody had a seat and stayed there and were part of a scene where it's worth noting that when the president did talk about the pandemic, it felt like he was speaking of it in the past tense. I mean, he still did say we are marshaling forces and we will beat this thing. But he also, along with other speakers all week, tended to describe it as if the worst is behind it, that decisive action was taken by this White House. He unequivocally said a vaccine is coming by the end of the year, maybe sooner. We don't know when the vaccine will come, and we're certainly not on the verge of a vaccine with only four and a half months left in this year. And the audience also looked as if this whole health crisis is in the past tense, given how they were sitting.
But as we know, it's not. I mean, that every day, you know, hundreds, if not even more than 1,000 people are dying because of the virus. What did you make of the use of the White House as a kind of campaign backdrop or even prop? How unusual to have a convention and such a partisan convention on the grounds of the White House.
I've been going to that building in the South Lawn for 20 years now, and I have seen a lot of pomp and circumstance in that building and on the grounds of the White House. I've seen state visits. I've seen the Queen of England standing there clutching her purse. I've seen congressional picnics and firework celebrations with military families. And I've seen T-ball tournaments. But nothing comes anything close to what I watched last night, a full-blown, all-out, unabashed political event for purely partisan purposes, complete, I should add, with an opera singer at the end, singing everything from Leonard Cohen to Ave Maria to God Bless America. It was something to see the White House decked out in such a partisan way for such a purpose. And again, look, every speech a president who's up for re-election gives in the Rose Garden or in the East Room or in the Oval Office, any of those remarks, yes, they are using the trappings of the office to convey who they are and that they are in charge and all of that. But this was different. Even from that, it was quite a display, right on down to the fireworks and the opera at the end.
All week, and certainly the president last night was basically selling Joe Biden as a radical socialist, that if he wins, the country is going to devolve into chaos and lawlessness. People know whether they actually know, but people think they know Joe Biden. Do you think that's going to work? A guy who I think is almost by all or any definition, a moderate. Do you think that's going to work?
Yeah, it's the latest attempt for them to define Joe Biden. I mean, for a long time it was Sleepy Joe, or they've had other things along the way. Now it's Joe Biden as the Trojan horse for the hard left of the Democratic Party, and for in the president's and other Republicans' words this week, for the radicals and the socialists. We heard this socialist word over and over and over, without noting that it was the self-avowed socialist who Joe Biden ran against and defeated quite soundly for the nomination, Senator Bernie Sanders. But they are indeed both trying to portray him both as as a tool of the left within the Democratic Party, or one who will just be able to be manipulated by the left, and expect them to continue to hammer that and use the violence that we're seeing and the protests that we're seeing and everything else around the country as part of that narrative. But then I guess the contradiction there is that they also paint Biden as kind of this cunning person who's going to destroy your way of life and impose all of these things that he'll be able to get through Congress and the like through. So it's it doesn't always line up, but they did give us a clear picture of where they will be going in terms of the line of attack on the Democratic nominee for the last 9 weeks or 10 weeks or wherever we are right now, nine, I guess.
You wrote an interesting article, an interesting piece earlier this week, looking at the Republican Party and looking at comparing, in many ways, Ronald Reagan to Donald Trump. Ronald Reagan famously going to Berlin saying, tear down that wall. Would Ronald Reagan recognize today's Republican Party?
Well, I don't want to speak for Ronald Reagan.
Of course not.
But I think he would certainly acknowledge that it's a very, very different Republican Party than the one that he both presided over and stamped with his image, not just for his two terms in the White House, but really for decades afterward. Until Trump came along, you consistently would hear, out at campaign events or out at, county GOP offices or Lincoln Day dinners or whatever, references to this being the party of Lincoln. I'm sorry, the party of Reagan, the party of Reagan. And Reagan's name would be invoked all the time. And you'd still hear that a little bit, but mostly everybody, within the party, too, will acknowledge this is now the party of Trump. And the party of Trump is a very different party from the party of Reagan. And you're correct to note that Reagan was notable for taking such a hard line with the Soviet Union. It was not just Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, a controversial line at the time. In that speech at the Brandenburg Gate in 1987, but it was also in his dealings with Mikhail Gorbachev. They had many summits, but Reagan liked to say, trust but verify anything he heard from the Soviets. And you can compare that to President Trump with President Putin in Helsinki, where he was asked if he confronted Putin about U.S. intelligence coming to the conclusion that Russia had indeed interfered in the 2016 election, and the president, standing before the press and the world and next to President Putin that day, said his denial was very strong. I have no reason not to believe him. I don't know why they would meddle in our election. So that's a contrast, but it also speaks to the difference in the party. I talked to some Republicans who noted how it was the threat posed by the Soviet Union in the Cold War years that really did keep the Republican Party together. You also had a coalition that included social conservatives and business conservatives, kind of the Chamber of Commerce business community. And now that's all definitely out of whack. The national security component is changed in the way President Trump has changed his approach to the world. He's more of an American first type, and he is quick to criticize NATO. And the populists and the evangelicals are more ascendant under Trump.
Well, we could talk more, Don Gagne, but we got to end it there. Thank you so much for getting our conversation started.
I'm glad to be here anytime. Thank you.
You're welcome. Don Gagne, national political correspondent for NPR. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. The Republican National Convention is over after four nights pitching a second term for President Trump, who accepted his party's nomination last night. We're going to discuss who spoke, what was said, and in what ways the Republican Party is working to get the president elected, taking on his challenger, Joe Biden, whom Trump called a Trojan horse for socialism. Joining us is Joe Watkins. He worked in the Bush 1 White House. He's now host of State of Independence on radio station WBPH. Joe Watkins, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
And John Brabender is with us as well. He's a Republican strategist, chief creative officer at Brabender Cox, which is a media firm on the other side of the state in the Pittsburgh area. And John Brabender, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well. And hopefully we will get John Brabender up and running. In the meantime, you can join us.
I'm sorry. I wasn't speaking loud enough, but I wanted to thank you for having me, and I am here.
Okay, very good. We can start the show. And let me just give out how our listeners can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joe, let me just pick up on something that Don Gagne was talking about how President Trump has really reshaped the Republican Party in many ways, making the Republican Party in his image. There is no new platform. So it's essentially what the president wants to do is what will be the platform of the Republican Party. How do you see the state of the Republican Party these days?
Well, I think that there are people that still hold fast to certain principles. For me, the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, and African Americans were members of that party in big numbers all throughout the remaining 1800s and the early 1900s. And I joined the party because in the 1950s, the Republicans were the ones that put forward the first civil rights legislation, the Civil Rights Act of 1957, sponsored by people like Senator Bill Noland and pushed hard by President Eisenhower and then Vice President Richard Nixon and many, many others. Prescott Bush in the U.S. Senate and others were big supporters. And that's what got me to join the Republican Party. So
is that the same party today, though? I mean, do you recognize that party today?
No, well, the party changes with the leadership, of course. It was a very different party under President Ronald Reagan than it was under President Eisenhower. It's yet still a different party under President Trump than it was under President George H.W. Bush or George W. Bush. So, yeah, the party has a tendency to take on the persona of the person who's running it.
John Brabender, let me turn to you. And we did a show last Friday looking at the Democratic National Convention, doing some deconstructing of what was said there. What was the main message that you took away from the RNC this week?
Well, I think, as was pointed out, the Republicans did go very strongly and I think effectively showing a lot of diversity, showing diversity both in race but also in gender, with a lot of women playing significant roles. I think what they did smart was showing a lot of real people. I think people prefer to watch that rather than one politician after another after another. And I think also what they did is they allowed them to talk about not their preference for Donald Trump as much as how Donald Trump has favorably and effectively changed their life through different programs like school choice that helps a lot of African-American families now have a choice of not just being stuck in a school that they don't want their children to go to, but have options. Or, you know, they had vets talking about how now their health care for the first time has been changed. It gives them options to go outside the VA hospitals if they're not getting the, you know, what they deserve there and have earned and so forth. And I think putting a face to a lot of these stories, they did a nice job. And I thought one thing that I was glad was they didn't spend the whole time just saying, here's why you have to vote against Joe Biden and the liberal left. They did spend a significant amount of time talking about, here's why you have to vote for Donald Trump. So considering the limitations that both these parties had in how do you put on basically an event like this where you don't have these huge live audiences filling an arena, which usually create a certain type of energy. I think it was a challenge for both of them. And I think to some degree, both of them pulled it off. But I think it was a more important convention probably for the president. And I think they probably are smiling right now.
Picking up on the race issue, and Joe, I do want to go back to you. I was looking at a number of polls, at least as it stands today, looking at Joe Biden compared to Donald Trump and when it comes to support among Black Americans. Biden generally in the upper 80s, low 90s, and the president unable to really get into double digits. What is his problem with Black voters?
Well, I think that that those polls are pretty accurate, that Joe Biden has strong support from African-American voters across the board. I think the challenge for Joe Biden is that he needs an Obama-like turnout in November from African-Americans. He needs to get well over 90% of the African-American vote, I think, to be competitive in this cycle. And I think whether you're a Democrat or Republican, for anybody that was watching the Republican convention the last four nights, you saw people like Alice Johnson, who spoke passionately. I mean, she's a real person who was incarcerated, first-time offender, drug offender, given a life sentence plus 25 years, and President Trump saw fit to commute her sentence and to get her, have her freed. And she spoke very passionately and about her experience with the president and what the criminal justice legislation that he sponsored and signed into law has done for people like her. That's powerful on TV. That's very, very powerful. So it's not going to win the president the black vote, but it may shave off a few percentage points. So I wouldn't be surprised if the president was edging closer to getting 10%, 11%, 12% of the black vote, which still is a small percentage, but it's a meaningful percentage in what is likely to be a very tightly contested campaign.
But, Joe, how do you balance that with the message, not necessarily last night, but it's been over the last couple of weeks, of the president talking about suburban housewives, people living in the suburbs, and people, and I think we can read between the lines so we know what he's referencing, talking about low-income people moving near you, threatening you. I mean, how do you balance, and I agree with you, I thought Alice Marie Johnson was inspiring, and she was really a very riveting speaker, but how do you balance her anecdote, her story about her life, with what has been coming from the president himself?
Well, at least during the days of the convention, I think the people that put the convention together realized that it's an a la carte menu, and people are able to take from it what they want. And so they had something for everybody. So there was something for people of color. If you care about what happened to George Floyd and you want to see legislation passed that calls for police standards, national standards among police. You heard Tim Scott talk about that and some others as well, very passionately about what they're doing. And then you heard, if you care about criminal justice, you heard what Alice and Johnson had to say and some others. And then if you're a suburban house, suburban white women heard.
There aren't too many housewives left in the world.
That's correct. I changed my.
You caught yourself.
Respectful.
Yes.
I caught myself. No, but for suburban women, it was important for them to hear that the president wants to keep them safe. And so they heard that message. That message was played over and over and over again for them. And you heard it from police and from who spoke at the convention and various others who spoke very passionately. The wife of that slain former police captain in St. Louis, Dorn, she spoke very passionately as well, even though her children aren't with her. So I think that for anybody watching, they got what they wanted. And again, you're not going to win over audiences, but to the degree that you shave off a few percentage points, that becomes helpful to your cause if you're the president and his campaign team. So I think they got done what they wanted to get done in these 4 days. Now the challenge becomes is what do you do going forward? Sure. How do you deal with the protests going forward? How do you show sensitivity to the issues of yet another black man being shot in the back, and at the same time talk about the need for safety for people? That's going to be the challenge going forward between now and November.
Let me play another clip, and this is actually former football star Herschel Walker with his speech at the RNC, and this was broadcast on Monday night. And John Brabender, I'll give you a chance to respond. Let's listen.
It hurt my soul to hear the terrible name that people call Donald. The worst one is racist. I take it as a personal insult that people would think I've had a 37-year friendship with a racist. People who think that don't know what they're talking about. Growing up in the Deep South, I've seen racism up close. I know what it is, and it isn't Donald Trump. Just because someone loves and respects the flag, our national anthem, and our country, doesn't mean they don't care about social justice. I care about all those things. So does Donald Trump.
John, to give you a chance to respond and also to put it in some kind of context, I mean, it should be said that Donald Trump was a birther, which I think is one of the definitions of what a racist language sounds like when you say someone who's a person of color is not from this country. They are foreign. They are alien. Can you speak to that?
Well, first of all, I did think on Monday night Herschel Walker and Senator Tim Scott, who's also African-American, both did great jobs talking about this president and why they support him and the true Donald Trump. I think what you see that the Republicans are trying to do in this president is say to the African-American community, don't look at the criticism I'm looking compare my record to those who came before me. Number one, criminal justice reform. Everybody promised you that. The Democrats always promise you that when it seems to be election time. But I got it done. So who really is on your side? Look at education. We now have historic investments in African-American colleges and universities that came out of the Trump administration. So if we're going to talk about the importance of education for everybody, including African-Americans, who got it done? And President Trump's going to say he did. Look at the all-inclusive economy, where we set a record for the lowest unemployment among African-Americans in our country's history. So Donald Trump's going to talk a lot this fall about how he went and fought to make sure that we had an all-inclusive economy, not where there's winners and losers. So if you remember 4 years ago, he said, "What do you have to lose in supporting me?" And his point at the time was, it seems like every 4 years, the Democrats come around and tell you, as Biden most clearly said, you're not black if you don't vote for Joe Biden. And a lot of people found that offensive because it was limiting who they are, but it was also saying, we don't have to earn your vote. You should automatically give it to us. And so I think you know, Joe Watkins made a really interesting point in saying, you know, Donald Trump doesn't have to get 25% of the African-American vote. He got 7% last time. If he moves that up to 10 or 11 points that he gets this time, that percent, all of a sudden we fundamentally change the race. And I think what's symptomatic from the Democrat standpoint that they have a problem among African-Americans is that this week Joe Biden put up three different ads targeting African-Americans. And so I think they know that they have a problem, and they see that they're losing some of those votes. And I think that the fact that they're starting to spend a lot of money trying to advertise what normally would be a natural constituents for the Democrats, you know, that they generally ignore at election time as far as spending on ads and so forth, they realize that they do have a problem. And so I do find this kind of interesting, how you have a president who, on one hand, the Democrats love to call him names and accuse him of things. On the other hand, they seem to be extremely worried that they're losing African-American voters to Donald Trump.
Well, and I think there's no question that African-American voters have been among, if not the among the most loyal voters in the Democratic Party. Joe, let me put something to you. The president, I'm not sure he was president yet, but I think he was, but he certainly was running for president 4 years ago when he said, "I alone can fix it." And yet, listening to the Republican convention and this week, and even the president last night, he seemed to think that all the problems that we have, and there are multitude problems, are because of Joe Biden. Can you make sense of that?
Yeah, I can make sense of that. I mean, of course, in the heat of a campaign, the challenge for anybody running is to paint their opponent a certain way. And Joe Biden clearly is not a far left candidate for the presidency. But nonetheless, the job of Joe Biden and the job of Donald Trump is to paint the other in an unfavorable light to people who are likely to vote in November. So I think in the coming weeks and months before the election, it's going to get more heated. You're going to hear each of them try to paint the other as the more dangerous person to lead the country going forward. And that's just sadly the reality that we're going to face. You're going to see ads that are going to be very targeted and probably very negative going forward on both sides of the aisle, because this is going to be a hard fought campaign. So there'll be things that when they're fact checked are not true, but that's not going to necessarily change the ad buy.
John, let me go back to you. And I was talking with Don Gagne about this at the start of the show, just looking out at the White House lawn, the South Lawn last night. You had something like 1,500 people. They were not socially distanced. Many of them were not wearing masks. And there's a lot of worry among public health people that this could be a spreader, a COVID virus spreader event. And we know, as much as the president was trying to tout his accomplishments when it comes to the pandemic, 180,000 people have died. Our track record compared to other countries is really fallen short. And if we wore masks and if we social distanced, we could have some of our economy back. How do you understand the message coming from the White House and from the president himself related to this virus?
Well, what we don't know is a sizable number of those people were actually tested for COVID in recent days. And there are some things, if you look, a lot of those were administrative officials who work at the White House who are tested on a daily basis in most cases. And so, you know, there were plenty of people there with masks and so forth. So what the protocols were set up for last night, I'm sure there were a lot of precautions taking place. But I think what was more important, what came out of there, was the night before Mike Pence said, by the end of the year, we're going to have a vaccine. And the president reiterated that last night. And they're on the front lines. I mean, you know, the United States is making an unprecedented investment in rapidly getting this vaccine. I mean, the race to get it by every country, but the investment by Americans is just remarkable. And the fact that, you know, the studies are going that well and they feel confident enough to make that bold, you know, statement, I think is what really most people are going to leave there from last night relative to COVID. I think it's what everybody's been waiting to hear. And that is that there's light at the end of the tunnel, that there's a vaccine that is not that far off. And I think that's the hope people want. Because it lets them.
But is it true? I mean, I think the question is, we all hope for that. The president talked about a miracle. We've all hoped for that. But can you promise that?
Well, what we do know from independent sources is that there are multiple U.S. companies, as well as companies outside the U.S., that are in their final stages of trial and that they all feel confident. In fact, they've already started the plans for all the manufacturing of it so that once the study is completed and somebody is successful, or multiple companies they believe it'll be, that they can immediately move into the mass production of this.
And you know what, sorry to interrupt you. We have to take a very short break, and then we're going to get back to our conversation. Talking with John Brabender, he's a Republican strategist, chief creative officer at Brabender Cox. Joe Watkins is with us as well. He worked in the Bush 1 White House. He's the host of State of Independence on WBPH. He joins us on WHYY, talking about the convention. We'll be
supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with our guest Joe Watkins and John Brabender about the Republican National Convention that was held this week, concluded last night with President Trump accepting his party's nomination to run for re-election. I know, John, you were in the middle of a thought. I've got a bunch of comments here I want to put out there. We've got some calls as well. And I should add that you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just read a couple of comments, and then we'll get Diana in on the conversation. Mark says, if Biden can be falsely assailed as a socialist, is it a stretch to fairly characterize Trump as a fascist? A comment from Bertha. Trump says he's going to restore law and order, but it seems like he's broken a lot of laws. How does he define law and order, and what does that mean? A comment from Douglas. Last night's speech was held on federal property and involved federal employees campaigning on that property. This is illegal according to the Hatch Act. A comment from Dave. I feel like Trump's pitch of being a criminal justice reform president while also pitching himself as tough on crime president is confusing. Is this intentional? Let me get Diana, who joins us on line one, to join our conversation. And Diana, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have Diana?
Yes.
Let me read what she was going to say. She was going to say, people keep saying that Trump and the Republicans aren't racist, but Mary Ann Mendoza, a QAnon supporter and racist, was one of the highlighted speakers before she got pulled from the list. How do you explain that? John Brabender, can I toss it back to you?
Well, the one thing I do know is that the campaign was made aware of some statements that they thought was inappropriate, and they did the appropriate thing and pulled the speaker. And really, that's what it comes down to, isn't that? That when you find somebody that you feel is outside the mainstream of what you believe, that you're not going to give them a national audience, and that you pull them. So I think really what this said is that You know, this president, you know, is serious about making sure that we have people who understand the power of rhetoric and how it can hurt and who you fight for and what you say. And I think the convention took appropriate steps, and I think they should be commended, not criticized for that.
President Trump, though, when asked about QAnon, first said, I don't really know anything about the group. But then he added, but I hear they like me. And he seemed to like that idea.
Well, but he said he didn't know anything about the group. So in fairness, you know, it's like asking somebody, what do you think about so-and-so who lives down the street from you? And if you don't know anything, your first inclination is not to say anything bad. So, you know, let's be fair to the president on this. But, you know, more importantly was not who didn't speak. More importantly was who did speak. And, you know, I'll give you an example. You know, there was a number of people that were part of a video the vice president did on Tuesday night. Two were African-American who wrote letters to the vice president talking about their support and their thanks. And so then they reached out and said, would you be willing to say that nationally? And one is a former Superior Court judge, Democrat from Pennsylvania, Cheryl Allen, who talked about she did not support President Trump in 2016, but she's supporting him now because she believes he does get the problems that African-Americans are facing today, that he is willing to be at the table and come with real solutions. And she was the one who asked if, you know, she could talk. And so I just think that having so many people like that who are very credible from different walks of life, from different communities that are standing up for the president says a lot versus when the DNC starts putting out talking points trying to criticize the president.
Let me go to you, Joe Watkins. And it was interesting, and I think for some people surprising, how many Republicans spoke at the Democratic National Convention. I'm thinking of John Kasich. He got more time than Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to speak, Christy Todd Whitman, other members of the Republican Party, a number of Republican aides who worked for George W. Bush and John McCain and Mitt Romney wrote a letter in support of Joe Biden. They said, while we disagree with some of his positions, we value his bipartisanship. We feel he can deal with a pandemic and some of these political divisions. What do you make of, and of course, the Never Trumpers are out there as well. What do you make of the Republicans who are being very outspoken in their criticism, not just of the president, but also their support of Joe Biden?
I think they're being honest. I mean, I think you're going to continue to see some high level defections on both sides. People who you may be surprised to be supporting either one of the candidates for president. And clearly, a number of those high level defections on the Republican side have been very, very public. Some very high, well-known people choosing to openly support Joe Biden in his bid for the presidency. But the election in general is not going to be won or lost on the defections of some of these big names and of people who've worked in past administrations. It's going to be won again on the margins. It's a matter of these conventions are meant to gin up the base, get the base excited, and then to add to the support that already exists and to chip away at the support for your opponent. So if that was the hope for this convention, I think they got that done. And I say that in a completely analytical way that I thought the Democratic convention was successful the week before. I thought the Republican convention was perhaps more successful this week in terms of reaching out to those voters, again, suburban women and to African-Americans, just to chip away at those numbers and to maybe get a few more percentage point in the Trump column. And I think that they may have accomplished that goal.
John Brabender, both conventions were fact-checked. We talked about the Democratic convention last week and talking about the Republican convention this week. And to be very honest with you, I was checking the fact-checkers this morning, and there were some long lists of either false statements or misleading statements. One thing the president said that was so easily fact-checked, he said that when the Democrats were at the convention, when they were saying the Pledge of Allegiance, they left out "under God." Not true. Easily fact-checked. Why does he do that? Why does he say things that are not true that can be so easily exposed as being true?
Well, I'll save that question for you to ask the president next time you're talking to him.
Fair enough.
because I'll
but doesn't that create though problems for other Republicans and for strategists like yourself?
But I will tell you what. I mean, I wrote an article for the Wall Street Journal 4 years ago, exactly about this time before the election, where they asked me, how in the world is Trump going to get to the magic, 270 number of Electoral College votes? And I took a hard look at it, and what it really came down to was that it was the sons and daughters of Reagan Democrats who lived in states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan, that the president had to get a sizable number of them, which the Republican Party hadn't in a long time. And when you looked at why they were able to get for him, one of the reasons was that they really liked that Donald Trump had an economic plan that was going to, have very tough and fair trade deals, was going to take on China, things that they thought were going to directly impact their take-home pay and their job security. But one of the other things that they felt very strongly is that the Democrat Party is moving away from anything to do with, the right to own a gun, the right to pray in public, a lot of the sort of social, cultural morals that they grew up with. They felt that the Democrat Party is moving rapidly towards a more socialistic sort of viewpoint. And I think that's, again, why the Republicans are pointing out people like the Bernie Sanders of the world that seem to be greatly empowered now in the Democrat Party. In fact, Bernie Sanders on the first night of the convention said something really interesting. He said what was just seen as radical a couple years ago is now seen as mainstream in the Democrat Party. I'm guessing that was probably a nightmare statement for Biden, but what it shows is that Bernie Sanders is as much in charge here in some sense as Biden is. He's the one setting all the policies where it seems like the party is going on the Democrat Party. So I think what you see is a lot of blue-collar, conservative Democrats who look at this and saying, that is not the party that I joined. And I think that's why Trump did so well in Rust Belt states and was the first Republican in many years to win states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. And I think it'll be critical for the president to do well there again to win in 2024 or 2020, rather.
I wonder, Joe, when picking up on what John Brabender was just saying there, though, when you look at what's in the Democratic Party platform, it's universal health care, child care issues, something, frankly, that Ivanka talked about last night. And while they can be framed as really progressive socialist ideas, in many ways, they are very popular with the American people who, many of whom are struggling just to pay their rent and cover their expenses.
Well said, Marty. The challenge is in any political cycle, in any election cycle, is to reach the voters where they happen to be right now. And President Trump continues to do really well with non-college educated whites. That's a majority of the country, of the white populace. And he does very, very well with them. And that's going to matter, especially in these battleground states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Ohio and some others. So he's been able to find a tone and a message that has their confidence. And unless Joe Biden can break into that, I think that he'll continue to control to do well among that group, and that's his base. That's his base of support, and so I think this is going to be a very hotly contested election. I think right now that Donald Trump has maybe even a slight advantage because he's been rising in the polls the last couple of weeks, and he probably gets a bump coming out of this convention. So going forward, that'll be the challenge for Joe Biden. To dig into the president's existing base in the same way that the president is reaching out for some of Joe Biden's base.
Let me read some more comments. One from Mel: I think focusing on the White House and the Hatch Act, as many Democrats are doing, is not worth it. Comes off like a kid tattling. Most people don't really care about petty rule breaking. A comment from Michael: Trump takes a lot of credit for the stock market, but it's inflated by federal asset purchases, and this will eventually hurt investors in the long run. An email from Kristen: there is no mystery as to why BIPOC, Black Indigenous People of Color, voters are not on the side of Trump, and why his numbers are so low. Your guests are referring to policies that were put in place as a talking point to trot out as optically allyship with black and brown people. An email from Beverly in reporting on Trump's speech, every major news source, including NPR's, had to focus on fact-checking because it was so full of calculated misinformation. How can a moral person support someone who so deliberately distorts the truth? So a bit of a snapshot about what people are, what people, meaning listeners of WHYY and Radio Times, are thinking about. John Brabender, going forward, we got, what, a little more than 2 months until the election. We're here in Pennsylvania. Do you see Pennsylvania as, if not a battleground state, the battleground state?
Yeah, it could be both. I mean, it is very, very difficult for President Trump to win re-election without winning either Michigan, Wisconsin, or Pennsylvania. He doesn't have to win all of them. He has to win one of them, assuming that he keeps Ohio and keeps Florida. And so I think that I know for sure you'll be seeing the president and the vice president and others coming to Pennsylvania. I think you might have seen the stories out this week that there's some criticism by Democrats that are a little worried that Biden is not out there. And so I think it's to be determined whether we're going to see Joe Biden out there or if he's just going to stay in a room and do Zoom videos all day. But with that said, I think, you know, when you look at the diversity of Pennsylvania, both economic, by race and other factors, the geographic breakdowns, it's really like running seven different campaigns because you have that many different media markets in Pennsylvania. And so and unfortunately or fortunately for the viewers, they're going to be inundated with a remarkable amount of diversity of TV commercials as well. And so
buckle up, right?
And what's happening now is we're moving from early on in presidential races to referendums. Do you like the incumbent or don't you? But starting about Labor Day, everything shifts to what we call a choice election. Do I want Trump or do I want Biden? And generally speaking, that most people would agree. I think that that's probably a benefit to the Trump campaign, but we will see. But I think, you know, I think you're going to start hearing more about Joe Biden, or at least equal amounts of Joe Biden, than just Donald Trump. And I think people will start really formulating where they are on this race. Mm-hmm. And we'll see a certain amount of fluidity in these polls now that the conventions are over. We're going to see where we stand today and how are they going to start moving.
Joe, we're almost out of time here, but you've been in politics so many years. I just want to ask how, and I'm quoting from Rand Paul here, who called Donald Trump a delusional narcissist, an orange-faced windbag, a bully, a fake conservative. And yet there he was this week on the stage at the Republican National Convention telling people to vote for Donald Trump. How, as a political person, and I think for those of us that are sort of outside the system, how do you square that?
Well, I think for most people who are in politics, or for many people in politics, it's a matter of what they need to do. Certainly just to keep themselves in place and what they need to do to be viable going forward. And so it'd be hard for Rand Paul as a Republican senator from Kentucky to be viable in his state or nationally if he isn't supportive of the party's nominee for president, especially given the fact that Donald Trump has a very good chance of being reelected. So I think Rand Paul is doing what he thinks he has to do. And for better or for worse, I think that's how he sees it.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Joe Watkins. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're welcome, Joe. And he worked in the Bush One White House, host of State of Independence on WBPH. And John Brabender, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. He's a Republican strategist, chief creative officer at Brabender Cox, which is a media firm in Western PA. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can certainly leave more comments on our Facebook page, a conversation we started yesterday. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Henson. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.